Director at UW Parkside, and Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Good morning. This is Len Iaquinta for Community Matters. Today, we're learning about gray divorce. That divorce is later years, and Southeastern Wisconsin professional advisors are seeing more and more and more of it. We'll learn about it today from the angle of financial and estate planning. My guest is Kelly Mold, JD, CTFA, CWS, and CDFA. I'll ask her to decode all those letters after her name in a moment. Kelly Mold is the Senior Vice President and Wealth Fiduciary Advisor for the Johnson Financial Group. Good morning.
Good morning, Len.
Ms. Mold, Kelly, please tell us what those credentials are after your name and how they qualify you to talk about the financial and estate issues that come with a divorce after many years of marriage, gray divorce.
Yes, Len, that alphabet soup after my name can be a little confusing. I'm an attorney, hence the JD. When I was practicing, my primary area of concentration was family law and estate planning. I also spent several years as a guardian ad litem for Racine County, dealing with protective placements, divorce custody disputes, and cases of child abuse and neglect. I am also a certified trust financial advisor, certified wealth strategist, and certified divorce financial analyst. In my capacity as a wealth fiduciary advisor for Johnson Financial Group, I do trust administration, financial planning, and provide estate planning information, working closely with clients and their estate planning attorneys. I help clients navigate a myriad of financial concerns and options depending on their life stage and life events, which can run the gamut from financial planning in those early stages of career, marriage, and family to later life, such as, you know, funding college, health concerns, retirement, and sometimes restarting after a divorce. Financial planning and estate planning considerations are critical at all these stages.
Ms. Mold, your title talks about you being a fiduciary advisor. Oh, do you want to explain to us what that means? It's an important term, and I don't think that our listeners are probably all acquainted with what that means and what it doesn't mean.
Right. It's a legal standard of care. It basically says that when I am advising clients, I have an obligation to do what is in their best interest, to make recommendations in their best interest above everything else. So when we're talking about it might be looking at some of the options they have for investments and what ways they should strategize, it's imperative that I'm looking at their entire situation and that my advice is always done with the focus on what's in their best interest versus the company versus anything else that would come into play. So it's very important to have someone with that fiduciary designation.
All right. So if I'm looking for a financial planner or a financial advisor, I'm well advised then, as I understand it, to look for someone who's acting as a fiduciary.
Correct.
And that has a legal meaning. And when you ask that term, it has a legal weight in terms of whether the person says yes or no, and they better be honest, right?
That's right.
All right. Kelly, you made a superlative presentation on the topic of gray divorce, divorce among seniors, recently at the Estate Planning Council of Racine and Kenosha. And I'm a member, as you know, so that's what's led to this public service informational program today. Kelly, you're the financial senior vice president there at Johnson Financial. Could you describe for us what are the trends in gray divorce? Maybe to start, you might define the term gray divorce better and let us in on what's happening, please.
Sure, sure. So gray divorce is a term that refers to the increasing divorce rate among couples that are age 50 and over. While the overall divorce rate has been declining in recent years, for example, in 2019, we actually fell to a 50-year low, the number of divorces for people over 50 is surging, roughly doubling over the last 25 years. Some of the reasons we're seeing that now are because, as you can imagine, people over 50, they tend to fall into this baby boomer generation. And so there's definitely some attitudes, behaviors, and situations that baby boomers have found themselves in that have, I think, led to this this almost 25-year surge in divorce in that segment.
And how has this affected us locally? Are you you're talking about national figures here? What about here in southeastern Wisconsin? You're in very close touch with your colleagues in accounting and estate planning at the banks and the lawyers who specialize in senior law and marriage and divorce law. Is that the case here in southeastern Wisconsin too?
Yes, we certainly. When I was practicing, and I no longer practice, but when I was in practice, I saw a fair amount of that, and my colleagues continue to see increases in that area. Although some of the issues that are facilitating this have changed in recent years. When we look at this particular segment, we've seen that attitudes towards marriage and divorce have continued to change. And some of this is absolutely, you can see is colored by the generation, the attitudes towards marriage and divorce. So we know that baby boomers tended to marry early, and that they grew up in a much different environment than what we see today. So while the I'll step back just a second. While we're seeing the divorce rate decline, it's important to note that so too is the U.S. marriage rate. That also reached an all-time low in 2019. So we're seeing a lot of changes in both marriage and divorce. As gray divorce typically involves baby boomers, those born between 1945 and 1964, we have to kind of look at the history of what they've experienced and why they seem to have a little less stability in terms of marriage. So when we look at those babies, those were the individuals that were part of the massive increase in births following World War II. And those children grew up, their parents actually were the beneficiaries of something that in 1944, President Franklin Roosevelt signed, and that was the Servicemen's Readjustment Act, more commonly known as the GI Bill. And what that did is for the first time in our history, when the servicemen came back from World War II on a very large scale, they had access to job training, educational assistance, low or no interest home loans. And we saw this massive move to the suburbs, this massive increase in the birth rate. And so came on the baby boom generation. And these children were the first children reared on television, the first generation to be exposed to this consumerism attitude by a barrage of marketing through primarily TV and radio. This generation hit their stride in the 60s and 70s, and they started to accelerate change. We saw the kinds of activities that was happening in the 60s and in the 70s. And in the 70s, they moved to more social concerns, the Bill of Rights, women's rights, affirmative action, where their parents typically married young and stayed married regardless of the situation. Baby boomers also married young, but by the 70s, they started to divorce at ever-increasing rates. And by 1979, we had reached an all-time high of a 50% divorce rate. That's the stat you commonly hear referred, that one out of two divorces end in one out of two marriages end in divorce, but that's not accurate. 1979 was the only time that we saw that significant level of divorces. And by the 80s, their attitude started to swing to a more conservative perspective. Their children were approaching college age, AIDS tempered behaviors, and boomers started to focus on money and technology. And the boomers that divorced in the 70s were typically remarried relatively soon after. Those remarriages tend to be what we see today in this gray divorce. Not all, but very often they're a second or third marriage. And remarriages are three times more likely to end in divorce than first-time marriages. But the marriages don't necessarily end quickly. Often with a gray divorce, we see that a party needed to reach a milestone. The children needed to be adults or out of college or married. We also see some of the more common triggers, such as empty nest syndrome, retirement, addictions, infidelity, financial stresses, disability, or illness. More recently, we've seen an increase in sexual orientation as a cause, as the party indicates they no longer want to live a life they feel is not true. Some of the observations my colleagues and I continue to see are that more women than men typically petition for divorce post age 50. They tend to be lower middle income, fewer high net worth individuals, as there's some research that suggests that financial security can be an insulator from divorce, with the caveat being that factors that threaten that attribute, like gambling, excessive spending, and addictions, would make that as likely to result in divorce as the others.
Well, that all makes sense. And that's good underpinning for why we're talking about that this topic this morning, because things have changed. Senior divorce is becoming much, much more common, and we're going to continue to see more of it. Isn't that right?
Correct.
So the purpose of this program really is just to raise our awareness of it, and also to raise the awareness of individuals and their family members of what are some of the factors that need to be borne in mind when you're going through this kind of a life change. Now, Kelly Mold from Johnson Financial, I want to talk about the special expertise that you and others like you bring to the table in terms of the practice of advising those who are in the midst of or are contemplating a senior divorce. I wonder if you'd maybe start by sharing with us what you've learned about the emotional and financial impact of divorce is at this life stage. I suspect you're finding, as a matter of practice, that it's a little different than what you might find with divorce in earlier years. Is that right?
Yes. Divorce is always traumatic. So I should be clear about that, that divorce is never easy. When we look at younger families or shorter term marriages that are divorcing, the issue, there's always the division of property. But in those divorces, there's also the very highly emotional issue of the children and placement and all of those issues. By the time we get to a gray divorce, the children are typically adults. That's no longer the primary focus. But the emotional toll is significant. Oftentimes after a long-term marriage, this couple has been defined as a couple. And that unwinding of that relationship and all that goes with that can be extremely traumatic for all the parties concerned, adult children, grandchildren, the spouses, you divide property. You know, sometimes there are people who think in terms of how do we divide our friends? How do we divide our support system? So it's an extremely, both financially and emotional, taxing experience. We often see in these types of divorces that women and families oftentimes carry that emotional labor. They are the ones that coordinate the family activities, that inform what's happening with what adult child. It's not always the case, but it's often the case. And as a result, women tend to continue to carry that emotional responsibility post-divorce. And as a result, they tend to, even after divorce, maintain very close, pretty solid relationships with the adult children, with the grandchildren. Even if they remarry, that still tends to be a focus of them. Again, not always, but when we're looking at some general research, that tends to be the case. It remains strong between the women. Research shows that men, not quite as strong. They tend to lose more from that familial relationship standpoint than the wives because they have not traditionally carried that proactive work to connect with the children. Again, not always, but certainly in many situations. And if there's a remarriage or repartnering for the male in the divorce, in the post age 50 divorce, excuse me, that tends to create an even greater divide. They tend to be less connected with the children of the prior marriage. They tend to go along with the new family environment. That said, from a financial standpoint, men tend to contribute more to adult children from a financial perspective than the wives. Now, some will say that's because they tend to have more financial ability to do that than the wives. And others have said, well, that also is the way that's kind of their language to connect. It's important to note, though, that some nursing homes recently have produced some data and said that they've seen a surge in what they refer to as kinless older adults, and that these are primarily male, that they've ended up in these care facilities with no external support system. And there is some theories that say that this is a part of this disconnection from the feeling and inability to maintain those connections long term. Again, I just want to be clear that these outcomes are not always the case, but some of the research has shown that these have been trends. From a financial perspective, divorces, especially great divorces, are extremely complex. There's often retirement assets, business interests, investments. For executive level people, we'd be looking at deferred income and some of the kinds of perks that go with higher executive level positions. Oftentimes we're dealing with blended families and sometimes marital property. Sometimes there is no marital property agreement. So you're starting to try to unwind what is an equitable solution. Courts, you know, there's this kind of fiction that we want marital couples to end up post-divorce in a similar position to what they were married. And that's very difficult when you're cutting all of the assets by half in many cases.
Let's talk about that a little bit more. But first, let me remind our listeners, for those who have just tuned in, that my guest on Community Matters this morning is Kelly Mold. She's the Senior Vice President and Wealth Fiduciary Advisor for the Johnson Financial Group. And we're talking about divorce after age 50 and the impact of that. Kelly, please go on and talk more about the financial impact on divorce over 50.
Sure. So, Len, oftentimes, and this is probably no surprise to your listeners, married couples will divide responsibility. Somebody will handle the finances, others will handle other parts of maintaining the marriage and the home and whatever has to happen. And as a result, there's oftentimes a spouse that is not aware of what, where, how much is happening from a financial perspective. When we deal with a couple that's going through a divorce at this level, it's very important that both spouses understand the financial landscape and what might happen post-divorce. So the first step typically in the divorce is to create what we call a financial disclosure statement. And that is to essentially gather every asset, every debt, figure out how it's titled, and make sure everything is accounted for. With second and third marriages, sometimes we will have the advantage of a marital property agreement that theoretically should help clarify anything brought to the marriage or by agreement the couple has decided or, you know, already determined what the ownership would be post-divorce. But in the absence of that, everything has to be gathered. And then the analysis has to happen to understand what an equitable distribution of both the debt and assets would be for the couple. This is a big step. I sometimes see couples just, people can feel so overwhelmed by it. They'll say, no, I'll just take whatever my spouse is saying, and they don't want to put the effort into it. But it is a critical and most important step at this point to understand not just what the assets are, but what it means if they were to be divided. And what is the advantage and disadvantage based on what debt and what assets you're taking?
It sounds to me like this is something that's way beyond the expertise of most of us, irrespective of your educational level. This has nothing to do with whether you're a college graduate or you aren't, or you're a PhD. This is really some specialized knowledge and almost detective work that has to be done in a sense to locate these resources that people may have that need to be shared or divided in some way. And what kind of a professional would help you do that?
So this is what, you know, so we live in this age of self-help and online everything, right? And so people think that they don't need the resources to do this and they'll work it out. And it's so traumatic. You know, you oftentimes see the attitude, we just want to get through it, which I completely understand. But to your point, this is extremely complex. And you want to assume everybody is being absolutely forthright with each other and disclosing everything. But certainly, Len, in my experience, I have seen situations where assets have been attempted to be hidden away from the other party in an attempt to get, you know, a less than equitable settlement. And so it's critically important that individuals hire experts with experience to help them through this. I don't know that everybody understands what the advantages and disadvantages are of dividing certain assets. And
why don't you tell us a little bit more about these marital property agreements, prenups, postnups, what that all means? Are they as ironclad as we think they are when we enter into them? And some of the other more detailed aspects. I think we have time to go into that in a little bit. Ms. Mold,
sure.
I think it would be helpful for our listeners to have just an idea of what they're getting into.
Sure. So, you know, marital property agreements get a bad rap because, you know, people immediately think that is, you know, a situation of distrust and already planning for the worst. And when you're talking especially about blended families, in fact, I just had a meeting with a couple that is getting married and they have grown children, and they're very knowledgeably going into a prenuptial agreement today to make sure that, you know, things are provided for the children of the prior marriages, and that, you know, they feel comfortable with what they're doing, which, you know, when they're establishing, you know, the beginning of their marriage and making sure these divisions happen the way that they want to, I think can be a very, very healthy and appropriate thing. The key with a marital property agreement is that you're disclosing everything to each other, that you're honest about what you have and where you want it to go. And that you're not creating a situation of duress where someone feels like they didn't really understand what they were signing, that they didn't understand what the terms were. But to put some of these things in place that are really important to people, I think makes some sense. And if they've already been divorced, if it's a second marriage or third marriage, you would think that they'd go, well, it's always possible, right? We've been through it once. So it's not like, you know, but love can distort a lot and make the future seem different. So it's surprising to me the number of people that I have seen enter marriage multiple times and not get the benefit of a premarital agreement to try to resolve some of this. But to your original point, that's one of the key reasons why if you don't have the marital property agreement, you absolutely want to have an experienced advisor, certainly a divorce attorney that can look for the right things and understand what the advantage is. So if you're dividing a retirement, what is that going to mean in terms of what you need to continue on? How is the tax impact going to affect you versus the other party? We live in a really complex world today. Attorneys have always dealt with hard to value assets such as businesses, where you need to have an appraiser come in and understand what the value of the business is. And are they joint partners in this business? Is one going to retain the business? Those can be very complex issues. And you need the proper valuations and understand what's going to happen going forward to do that. To try to do that without the help of experts is foolhardy. You want to be able to have someone that's looking out for both of your, not together, but each of you have representation that can look out for your best interests and help work through that. We have things today that we didn't have. So I stopped practicing to join Johnson Financial Group 7 years ago. And 7 years ago, I never had to figure out how to divide cryptocurrency for a couple. I mean, that can change value, you know, overnight. So how do you divide those assets? Another trend that we're seeing now is with people living longer and having adult children, as they decide, you know, I want a winter in Florida, but in Wisconsin, we think it's a great idea. We're going to just build an addition on our child's home, and, you know, we'll pay for the addition with the equity in our home. And then we'll have those in-laws quarters in Wisconsin to be with the grandchildren. And then we'll head to Florida for the winter and everything's going to be great. And then either the older couple decides to divorce or the child and their spouse decide to divorce. And all this was done on a handshake. So who gets the equity in the home? How is that divided? There are complexities that we didn't even think about 7 years. So you need to have experts working through this and trying to help come up with a solution that makes some sense.
That makes a lot of sense to me, and it's really quite fascinating. Are there other types of assets that are particularly problematical? You mentioned retirement accounts. I suppose life insurance, trust agreements, all these things are. Tell us a little bit more about the other kinds of assets that people might not think about so clearly.
So retirement assets are critical, and they're oftentimes the biggest asset that a couple has. And so how to divide those so that people have the benefit of both, you know, what their income should be, but also are mindful about what the taxes are. If you're under age 59 and you're taking the retirement asset and thinking that you're going to need that as income, that's going to impact your tax situation. And is that the best way to divide that? Also, people need to understand the difference between, you know, how to divide certain qualified retirement accounts versus certain IRAs, needing a qualified order to divide those assets is important. And an attorney can guide you through all those complexities to make sure you truly get the benefit of the asset that you were granted as a part of the final divorce decree. But it's, again, these can be so confusing, and people may not know what makes sense to have and what makes sense to give up. And that's where the guidance of both your attorney, and oftentimes the attorneys will use a financial advisor to help the individual prepare essentially a financial plan for what their life's going to look like post-divorce. Business interests are really important because, especially for the small business where both parties have been an integral part of the success of that business, can be really tricky. Do you sell the business? Does one buy the other partner out? Do you both want to continue on? That's probably the most unique circumstance where you create a new partnership agreement. But what does that mean long term?
I suspect there's no general rule of thumb on that, and that it's very particular to the circumstances of the couple.
Very particular to the circumstance and the couple, what the ultimate goals are and what's reasonable. You will oftentimes have people say, you know, this business has got my name on it. It's all about me. That's why it's worth so much. Well, the reality is, if one person is so tied to a business that without that person as part of the business, it simply loses all the same credibility that it had when the person was there, then that doesn't enhance the value. That actually reduces the value. It's too tied to one person. So there's lots of things that people think, and then there's what it really is when you bring someone in to appraise that particular asset. It just can be very interesting. You also have executives, C-suite executives, who get all kinds of perks that are fairly amazing. You know, you can have a company car, you can have a vacation home, you can have travel. There's all sorts of benefits that people may forget can count as income when you're dividing assets. So when the spouse that's leaving is not going to have the benefit of, you know, riding around in a company paid car, they're going to need to figure out how do you truly and equitably figure out what maintenance should be or what assets should be divided when they no longer have access to some of the perks that aren't traditional income.
Well, this is very enlightening. And I think that the point you've made about retirement assets is probably especially important because particularly professional couples can easily amass, if they've been together 30 years or so, could easily amass $1 million or more in retirement assets without being aware of it. If you're making regular and maximum contributions into retirement plans and maybe adding additional contributions, and with that time value of money compounding plus investment in the markets or in real estate, that can really be a lot of money. And it's it could be unwinding that is not always so easy, because retirement plans, is certainly in my experience, is that every different retirement plan from every different employer may have different restrictions on those accounts. And then there are the issues of has one partner to the marriage signed away rights for some of the benefits of that plan because they've decided to jointly make a charitable contribution at death. There's lots of things to unwind there, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And then, so that's why understanding your circumstance in the marriage and having a solid financial plan for what it looks like post divorce is critical. And also understanding then what does that mean for your estate plan? If you've done an estate plan together, obviously now you need to recraft your own estate plan as an individual. You may have the spouse down as your power of attorney for healthcare, your power of attorney for finance. You need to select trusted agents to be able to make those decisions for you. Presumably you don't want the ex-spouse to be still the one doing that. And so you have to think through all of those contingencies and make sure your estate plan now reflects what the goals that you have and relates to your new financial plan.
What about people who have kept collections? Sometimes people collect things like limited edition plates that turn out to have zero value. A friend of mine did that, had a limited collector edition of plates that he thought would earn him extra money in retirement. And it turned out that they were worth less than what it would cost to ship them to a willing buyer. But there are collections of coins, stamps, all sorts of memorabilia that people have that may or may not have value. And how do you divide those things? Or do you sell them? Do you get them appraised? What do people do with that kind of a thing? I have friends who collect cars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really interesting point because, well, first of all of us think all of our things are worth far more than they really are. That just tends to be the trend. If you talk to my mother, everything is an antique, everything is valuable, everything. And the reality is that that's not the case, especially in recent years, even as I work to help settle estates and things. In the past, people had more sentimentality, I think, around things like, you know, grandma's China collection and, you know, all these different things. And millennials in particular, they don't want that. There's just a different attitude about those things. So even the sentimentality attached with things has lessened over the years. And so trying to find a market for certain things has been harder. There's not a lot of value in some of the collections that people have acquired over the year, other than sentimental values. For things that we know have some inherent worth, there are individuals that collect very expensive artwork, or to your point, they may have classic cars that certainly do. Again, that's having trusted agents that have resources. So we would know a group of appraisers that would come in and specialize in classic cars or in artwork, those kinds of things that we know have some value. And then once the appraisal and the values are determined, then the couple and their attorneys basically take a look at how best to divide it. So typically, they'll come to an agreement. You take this asset, I'll take this asset, we'll agree to sell. You know, they try to negotiate an equitable solution to that. If they can't, that becomes one of the issues at trial. And then, you know, trial's expensive, right? So most good divorce attorneys will encourage, let's come up with a solution that's acceptable as opposed to battle this out in court, because then you know, the attorneys will make the money and the judge will decide, and oftentimes, nobody's all that happy at the end of it. So if you can come up with some agreement that gets you at least to some middle ground, that tends to be a better solution. But collections are really interesting. You know, I know I had an aunt that must have had, 30 Hummels, 40 Hummels sitting in the bedroom that everybody thought was worth just a small fortune. And, you know, they'd all go on a great cruise after they sold these Hummels. Everybody's aunt had 30 or 40 Hummels sitting next to the bedside table. So, it's just things, you know, you can appreciate the sentimental value and the memories that they provide to people, but the financial value typically isn't what people think for some of the more common collections.
And with the more nuclear family and not multiple generations living together or close by each other, I think that has probably broken that sentiment down some too. Well, this is all very helpful information, Vice President Mould from Johnson Financial. Individuals and our friends and our family ought to all be aware of these things. And this all suggests to anybody listening that as we intimated earlier, one or more financial advisors from various backgrounds might be necessary for each party to a senior divorce to have independently to ensure a fair division of resources, for example. Why don't you give us an overview of why maybe an attorney, an accountant, an appraiser, a financial advisor, and others all might best be part of the team of advisors that each party independently has. And you might talk about that, because you made quite a point about that in your presentation to the Racine-Kenosha Estate Planning Council, that you might not want to use the same advisors the couple used in the past, and that you shouldn't be using the same advisors. You shouldn't have the same attorney if you're entering into a prenup or a postnup. Each party should have their own attorney. Why don't you go into why that is?
Right. Well, the primary, you have to avoid conflict of interest. As a professional, if I put that hat on, you absolutely have to avoid a conflict of interest. Trying to represent competing parties, which is what a divorce is, that doesn't make a lot of sense, because what you want to be able to do is assure your client that you are working for solely what is in their best interest. Sometimes what is in one client's best interest is absolutely not in the best interest of the other party, correct?
Yes.
So each party certainly has their own separate divorce attorney. That doesn't mean that you can't collaborate and be reasonable. But what it does mean is that you have somebody looking it through a lens that focuses on you and your best interest. The same with a financial advisor. You may have had someone who has handled the whole pot or of assets or resources or investments for the family while the marriage was in place. But again, most often it's one party of the marriage that's typically had the contact, shown up at the meetings. They might inform the spouse, but there's one that has kind of led the way. And so then to try to suddenly be that advisor, create separate plans and work for both of them as part of a division, will put that advisor in an awkward situation. And again, you have to be very, very careful about the conflict of interest. There are enough really good fiduciary advisors in our area that we can find people that will really help and support the individual and give them the benefit of that expertise and the confidence of knowing that they're going to work towards what is in that person's best interest. And together, these professionals can help navigate a reasonable solution. And again, well, if that doesn't happen, it's a trial.
Now, what if one party or both parties say, oh, that'll cost money, I don't want to do that. What would you tell them?
Well, here's what I've seen. When people are so afraid to spend the money to have the expert advice and the people looking out for them, they tend to spend more money later trying to fix what they didn't understand to begin with. And it's not that I'm opposed to the self-help work. I'm like everybody else. The minute I'm coughing twice, I'm, going on WebMD and but at the end of the day, I still go to the doctor and I still hire the experts. Law school wasn't easy. There's a lot of information they teach you in that. And there's a lot that you gain from practice that the average person isn't going to know. And you want the best resource you can so that you know what your rights are, so that you know what you're likely to have. And having solid expertise behind you will make the process easier. And remember, this is an extremely emotionally taxing process. If you have solid advisors who can help navigate some of these choppy waters and get you to equitable solutions that are reasonable, they can remove some of that stress and really protect you down the road.
Kelly, why don't we go down the list of the kinds of advisors we're talking about here, and why don't you quickly tell us, enumerate them and tell us what each one is important for, just so people can clarify that in their minds.
Sure. Well, in a gray divorce, obviously the most important individual is going to be the party's divorce attorney. They're going to basically quarterback what they need to help their client navigate the financial issues and sometimes even emotional issues. Certainly when I was in practice, I had a group of therapists and counselors that I thought were helpful as well with clients and would make referrals so that my client could really, kind of work through things and be you know, as strong as they could to get through the process. So you want a solid, experienced divorce attorney, and there are many wonderful attorneys, luckily, in our area. And then oftentimes that attorney will want to work with the financial advisor or a financial advisor if, you know, the party didn't have one before, the person is working with the other client. So a financial advisor can help prepare a financial plan, can through that financial planning process create various scenarios depending on outcomes of settlement so that the client will know what they're looking at in terms of a post-divorce financial life. Oftentimes accountants to understand tax ramifications. They may have to bring in appraisers, separate appraisers to value business interests, or like you said, some of these, oftentimes they'll agree on an appraisal for property, for the home, for the family home, for those kinds of things. It's obviously cheaper for both if they can agree on an expert that would do an appraisal, because then they basically split that cost. But sometimes you see in businesses, they both insist on their own appraisal, or even sometimes on home. If they think somebody is not playing fair or not being forthright, they'll want to hire their own. But if you can agree on some of these experts that do the appraising for the assets, then you do save some money and it works well. So those are some of the things ultimately that you have. The attorney is really a great resource for, you know, especially divorce attorneys who do a lot of this practice. And divorce attorneys will specialize in some of these areas, dividing business interests or things like that. And they'll know, they'll have a list or a group of people that they can refer clients to or tap on for their expertise to make sure that they're getting solid information.
You made a reference to the fact that you have a list of behavioral counselors and therapists to help with mental and emotional issues that arise during these extremely stressful events. You want to just talk a little more about that and why you found that it's important? Because you're talking now from a position of observation and many years of practice yourself. I'd like to hear what you think about that.
Sure. So that was back when I was actually practicing in this area. And it was, when I was a guardian ad litem for Racine County, I had the benefit of being able to meet many of the mental health practitioners in our community and in our area. And as a result, was able to see some of the ones that I thought dealt with, you know, people kind of specialize, or experts will specialize in different areas, children, teenagers, you know, partners, relationships, those kinds of things. And when I was in practice, I did have several names of people that I thought did really great counseling or would really be helpful with clients who were going through a traumatic event such as a divorce. And divorce is traumatic. You are changing your whole life. Everything you thought that was going to be for the rest of your life is now changing. And you may have very good reasons for doing it. It just doesn't mean that you aren't going through this tremendous emotional strife. And it makes it very difficult to make good decisions or even evaluate information when you are so emotionally taxed. And to have a therapist or someone who can help kind of navigate some of those emotions and help a client feel stronger helps them get to the other side. And so oftentimes we would present these options, and if the client pursued it, quite honestly, I found that it really helped the process. They had someone who was essentially a third party that was just focused on their emotional well-being and could help them put things in perspective and gain the strength they need to follow through the process.
So that's a good thing to bear in mind, whether your attorney is as well connected as you were, Kelly, and does or doesn't suggest it, even on your own, you or your family members should consider that principle and keep it in mind. Is that what you would advise?
Yeah, well, yes. I think it's always helpful to know that this isn't just a financial unwinding when you're dealing with a divorce, that there is an emotional grieving process that people go to. And sometimes the help of a professional can make that process a little less traumatic.
Well, I want to thank you very, very much. This has been most enlightening and important, and something that is increasing. We're going to see more and more of this in our area. And now we know more about it. So thank you to my guest, Kelly Mould, JD, a senior vice president and the wealth fiduciary advisor for the Johnson Financial Group. We now know a little more about this phenomenon and the local resource professionals who can help one through it. So for Community Matters, this is Len Iaquinta urging you to get informed and get involved. Good day.
You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click shows. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and